So the Last Horror Podcast presents the Romero Sessions, a film-by-film look at the films, movies of George A. Romero, examining the films specifically that he directed over his career. So we'll start not with some of the adverts that he was making or the shorts, but during the 60s, but instead a film I've spoken about before, Night of the Living Dead. So Romero was 27 during the shooting of Living Dead. He'd already worked, so he was working in a business that he'd set up called Leighton Image that did advertising, including political adverts. Now, there's a good opportunity to talk about him and that kind of stuff in our next episode. But in a shooting that was kind of stop-start due to the nature of it. So we had a limited number of people, people giving up their time for free. And at the weekends, the film took 9 months to make, which is, a hugely lengthy shoot for any movie. But especially for something like this, which, could have wrapped up in a few days. But the issues, of course, with that were that they were very reliant on nighttime sets, on location shooting, and they were also very reliant on the kindness of friends and strangers as well. So, Night of the Living Dead, if you don't know it, is a 1968 independent American horror movie. Written and directed by George A. Romero and filmed in Pittsburgh. It is a story about a group of people who are trapped in a house, and outside, the dead have risen from the graves and appear to wish to kill them and devour their flesh. People often talk about Night of the Living Dead as being the first zombie movie. Now, that isn't strictly true. There in the past has been zombie films before, Plague of the Zombies, for example, or White Zombie. And those kind of zombie movies tended to be about voodoo or some kind of curse or magic. A little bit of racism sprinkled over the top. Night of the Living Dead helped create its own genre. That is true. And it did it by ripping up all the rule books. And it did it by predominantly being fiercely, fiercely independent from everything else. That 27-year-old surrounded by friends and business colleagues from his own advert production company were desperate to make a film, and a horror, as it is for a lot of filmmakers, seems like the best idea.
Well, you used to really be scared here.
Johnny!
You're still afraid.
Stop it now, I mean it.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're acting like a child.
Look, they're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
Johnny!
The thing about Night of the Living Dead specifically, and one of the reasons why it's so influential, is that the film almost goes out of its way to kind of be different, to stand out, which was understandable. You're making a debut feature away from the Hollywood system. You need to kind of stand out as much as you can. So it's more violent than a lot of films. Bearing in mind, this was made in the late 60s. Hammer was still popular. In America, we had film the AIP films. But this is a long way away from the gore and gritty independent film of the 70s and the violence of the excesses of the 80s. So why, how does it stand out? What makes it different? Well, it's easy to remember, to forget, but Barbara, who is a... When you listen to a lot of podcasts about this film, people will complain bitterly about Barbara. But Barbara, in effect, is our traditional entry point into a horror movie. She's the one who's first attacked. She's our damsel in distress, as it were. She's chased by a monster, and finds sanctuary, finds somebody who can kind of help her survive, and with a lot of films, she'd probably live. This is the post-Hitchcockian Psycho, though. Romero takes a bit of a leaf out of Hitchcock's book, but instead of killing our heroine at the end of the first act, instead what he does is he sits there and basically plants her down and makes it catatonic for the majority of the film. And that's why people hate her. Barbara does not fulfill expectations, and she's really struggling generally with life. Now, if you were actually in that situation, I think you might be a little bit kinder, maybe, to the Barbaras of the world. At least she's not, she might not be helping, but at least she's not kind of getting in the way. She's certainly not the hindrance of the family who emerge at the same point that she breaks down, the introduction of new characters to the story. With our family there, a husband and wife team and a young girl who is sick and is being injured by one of the zombies. So it's more violent. It contains characters that are different. And of course, there's another key element. Romero refers to again and again in interviews that he felt that it wasn't quite as deliberate as people were making out in terms of his films, that the films were reflections on the time rather than more kind of pointed creations. So Romero's argument in terms of Dwayne Jones's character of Ben being black is that it wasn't necessarily deliberate. He was the best actor for the time and, you know, that kind of thing. Which is an interesting response. What I think that points to is an idea, again, as Romero said, that the films kind of reflected the creation of the time. When Romero was sitting there and writing his script for Night of the Living Dead, he... was working with John A. Russo, who is was producer and worked with him on the Leighton Image advert company. They must have been influenced by the world around them, the world of Detroit, for example, which was slap bang in the middle of race riots, of social upheaval, of fighting for equal rights, equal opportunity, at a time when tensions were very high. And Ben's character is a man who is surrounded by threats constantly, and it's a powerful image, and certainly as it continues, and the tensions between, say, the older father and the younger Ben are really awkward and quite cringy at times, although they're really just arguing about the best course of action to keep themselves safe. There's more to the. There seems the dynamics between the two actors creates a far stronger and quite visceral element to the audience. There's also obviously the ending of the film, which I've decided I'm not going to do any spoilerific kind of stuff on these podcasts. But if you don't know what happens at the end, then you probably should be listening to this anyway. You should probably get on it first. But the ending of the film, it's matches the tone of the film totally. It has a feel, a bleakness to it, and there's more to this story than just Romero's wish to get the best person in it. It's of its time and ingrained so heavily in the DNA of the movie that it's very difficult to separate what Romero is trying to say and how he's been driven by what he's seeing all around him at the time. What I really wanted to do with these podcasts, though, wasn't to kind of go through the story or kind of say, well, you know, I like this one or this is my personal story around these films, because I've kind of covered all that. Indeed, I've really covered the history of it as well, although it's always bearing in mind and that Romero's the story of Night of the Living Dead is insane, and it does drive what we get to next for his next couple of films as well. So we'll rattle through that now, but then I'll go into more into what I'd like to talk about today. So the film was finished shooting in end of 67, early 68. Got a premiere and then hit the Grand Ole Circuit over the summer into October of 68. And then gone by 69. Got a reissue June 69, gone again. Gets picked up in France in 1970. And then another re-release happens, tied to the fact that the French have seen in the film elements that the American audience hadn't really picked up on at the time, on its initial couple of runs. The themes that we've spoken about in terms of with Ben's character, those dynamics, and the photography as well, which is something we'll get onto in a second. But and it kind of ingrained itself within the fabric of American horror, and its impact continued, buoyed by the fact that the copyright got fucked up. So the copyright for the film panel was dropped by accident, and therefore it wasn't properly registered as a film and therefore could be just shown on the Grindhouse circuits generally, which is a bit unlucky. Very quickly, then, I don't ever mention it before, but I hear this all the time. Well, that means you cannot show Night of the Living Dead in the UK out of copyright. It's not out of copyright. It's still owned by the copyright holders, even if there wasn't a distributor for it, which obviously there is at the moment, Criterion. The copyright would default back to the principal creators of the piece, so the guy who made the music, Romero, Russo. And even though Romero's dead, it's still referred back to his estate for 75 years afterwards. Anyway, just so you know, you've got a feeling that they want to do a thing. It's very vague and very tricky over here, and we try not to think about it too much when we're putting films on those kind of niggles with copyright. Probably always better to make sure the artists get paid. So Romero makes the film, and obviously, you know, its themes are spoken about a lot. The thing that always strikes me about it is twofold. One is it's fantastically well contained and structured horror film, but also how it plays quite differently on the small screen and the big screen. So it's an Academy 4-3 ratio, which is fine. and it is, yeah, and it's kind of a well-crafted kind of framing, in truth. So, like a lot of people, I watched it on the small screen first, and I have seen it on the big screen a few times as well. So it plays differently, depending on the screen you watch. No, I suppose that's true of all films, because, you know, you don't tighten the screen down. But with Night of the Living Dead on the television, its closeness kind of drags you to the screen. So it's kind of, because obviously, yeah, you know, you've got this very a traditional, I suppose would be the best way to put it, traditional framing with its Academy framing, and it's because of the way Ramirez shoots it, lots of close-ups of hands, close-ups of people twitching, of work happening. It focuses very much on flesh, even when that flesh isn't being chomped on, shall we say. Although it is very true to say, however, that it isn't designed in any kind of exploitative kind of sexual way. Indeed, unlike the films that horror films that were coming out around it, you know, there were no heaving bosoms and, you know, nudges and winks to what Dracula might be doing in the bedroom or in his coffin, should we say. But what those shots do is kind of make you feel very exposed. And the closeness of the framing with the Academy, and then the closeness of Romero within that framing, kind of tying it in, means that when something violent happens, you're very much part of it. And it does kind of suck you in. Now, that includes some of the more incredibly violent stuff, like the murders later on, particularly the trial murder with the young girl, which really kind of goes on for a long time. It's 13 stabbing shots in that scene, and all the images are very tight with the girl stabbing and then the victim screaming, and regardless of the music. Then there's the some of the eerie violence, like the obviously plasticine hand shock when the knife comes down and it kind of chops away the fingers, and there isn't any scare cords in on that shot. It's very documentary style. So on TV, it can kind of suck you in a little bit. On the big screen, it feels far more like a B-movie to me. It feels quite action-y, despite the slow burn. I think being on a very big screen broadens its palette out. Well, not its palette, obviously not its colour palette, because it's black and white, but broadens its visual palette out quite a lot. To really kind of... it echoes a bit more, shall we say. So that for me, on the small screen, the film is all about close-ups and acts of violence and driving the audience close to the screen. And obviously this is completely not what Romero had in mind, because, you know, it wasn't exactly running around, you know, this will be on TV loads. But on the big screen, a lot of the argument, the dynamics, the fight dynamics really come out to play on viewing. So the disagreements between the Coopers, that family, and Ben, particularly Harry and Ben. So, you know, I suppose in a sense, therefore, for me, the world of Night of the Living Dead on the small screen is very much the world of Barbara, kind of sitting down and closed and comatose and kind of in on itself and focusing on detail. And the world of Night of the Living Dead on the big screen is the Coopers, you know, bombastic, making some pretty bad decisions generally about Delaney's at points. And just really, though, frustrated and unable to organise stuff and fighty, really fighty and aggressive, you know. It feels a far more scrappier film on the big screen. And as I say, it does kind of play up its B-movie origins. It feels more like it's played up to its B-movie origins. Anyway. And a lot of the talk of documentary style, which often gets spoken about with Romero, it's almost necessity in truth. I think a lot of people will always kind of argue that Romero's necessity for the documentary was, you know, the style he was working in. But, you know, he used to make advertising. He was an advertiser. You know, he made advertising, made political party films. That kind of bread and butter work for him was far more about aping styles, aping ideas, telling puns, you know. It wasn't necessarily about making, you know, documentary footage. But I do think there is a necessity in terms of how the film's made. I think black and white probably was an incredibly fortuitous, although probably really because they had to, decision maker, because it probably got helped them get away with murder on some of the continuity and the day and night and all that stuff. It's also because of the equipment they were using, you know. It's urgency and agency is created in the film by moving that camera around, in truth, moving it around a lot. Romero's key elements in its creation are there are a lot of static shots, but the angles are a little bit strange, they're a little bit off, they're designed to unnerve you. But that, on top of the black and white footage, makes it feel more real. And again, you know, this is a horror film where Ben's character, you know, is fighting off hordes, fighting off violent white people, in truth. You know, and also setting fire to stuff to kind of guard them away, flinging fire around. And all the time, it's like you've got this twitchy camera that's focusing on hands and then flowing out and kind of being slightly off kilter. And it's what I'd say about it is it's not distracting. It's not like, like an Evil Dead thing where you're like, why is what? Well, not why is the camera doing that? But you know, a lot of the storytelling told through the camera work. It's not like that. It's more just you know, feels like right. We need to get this camera. We've got this scene. We set this up now, and it's done fast. What works as well is the fact that its believability is based on confusion. The characters of Night the Living Dead don't really understand what's going on. They've got an inkling that something has happened, but their stories, their notices, their vibe generally about, oh well, this is what this is. It's completely based on personal experience, as in, you know, that one of them's easy to sort out, but there's not one of them, there's loads of those kind of conversations. And television, of all things, the TV. The TV news section is interesting because it shows a very different world to the one that we're seeing. The world of Night the Living Dead in Night the Living Dead in that farmhouse is small, barricaded, toxic, hostile. The world that Romero shows on his television is aggressive, confused, but broader, wider. There's an element that the city, you know, the cities haven't been overtaken yet. The creep hasn't happened. Night of the Living Dead suggests an apocalypse that might not come, that we might get away with it. It's only just started. It's only been a few hours. And people feel like it might be under control, but there's already a heady confusion. But that personal experience marked with a very broad kind of quiet suggestion in terms of what might be happening, while simultaneously not really wanting to get into any real detail, get bogged down in what's going on. You know, it doesn't need a nuclear bomb going off like the 1950s. It doesn't need some kind of, I don't know, genetically modified spider or something to kickstart our horror. It just needs people in a room really concerned and frightened for their lives. The film, although has kickstarted, created one of the most successful blueprints for zombie movies, shall we say. Although it did that, its real influences on itself, European cinema in terms of its filmmaking, a bit of French in there, there's definitely some Spanish filmmaking, photography style, the, you know, I'm thinking, you know, the impact of the Spanish Civil War on art generally from the time, you know, I know the liner notes on the new Criterion release for Night of the Living Dead mentioned Goya, but there's certainly more, you know, horror tends to reference a lot of that kind of style. And then, you know, obviously in a pencil drawing, I think it probably is that kind of vibe to it, in truth. And again, that idea, though, is that a lot of art comes from the violence around it. So, yeah, so Night of the Living Dead took a few years to kind of hit its strides in America and really kind of find an audience. But when it did, it was, you know, very well received, and it laid the groundwork for Romero's career later. But that career really only took off 10 years after the release of this film. I think with Romero, and this is something I'll come back to again and again with his zombie movies, it can be tricky sometimes to really appreciate his films at the time they're created. And I know I've said this, I think I've said this on my podcast before, but A Night of the Living Dead was no different. It feels gritty and nasty and raw and maybe a bit too relevant for 68. But once, you know, the hippie dream had finally ebbed away and we'd entered properly into the 70s, Night could kind of start getting its reappraisal and people could see it more for what it was. But it, in the same way, a lot of horror, and as I was saying about Goya, you know, the influence of war on that artist. But also, you know, you could say, you know, like Last House on the Left, which obviously is a very different film to this, but also a debut feature, which came out roughly at the same time. Well, I mean, you know, came out 72, didn't it? So, you know, a few years later, really kind of still is marked by violence, you know, violence that's seen on screen. And I think when you reflect that violence back on to people who may are, you know, when you're in the moment, as we, you know, as we are currently in a moment, you can sometimes not see A, where your ideas have come from in the case of Romero, but B, kind of what it's really getting at. And art which bubbles up from the surface from its time can sometimes not be seen as quite as potent as it is done in retrospect years later. But, you know, Knight is a fantastically structured, designed, shot, written film. It has something to say about people, about society, and about America at that time. It's scary. It's shocking. It has moments that genuinely make you kind of recoil. It's incredibly atmospheric. It's a movie you can put on any time, and it just works. Romero made more than just a cult horror film when he made Night of the Living Dead. He made a genuine piece of art, and I am absolutely delighted that this film is in the Museum of Modern Art to print, which is where we got the fantastic Blu-ray that Criterion's done for Night of the Living Dead. I think, finally, moving on, before we kind of start, as though that as great as this film was and as how much heart and soul that Romero put into it at the time, in 1969, he wasn't receiving any of that benefit. He wasn't getting any money from it. They'd created a movie that potentially was not going to make any cash at all now because of copyright problems. Romero went back to work doing adverts and we'll pick up the story in terms of his next film and his advertising career next week when we talk about There's Always Vanilla. Okay, thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. Kept it relatively short because, dude, the world does not need another Night of the Living Dead podcast. And if I do the Section 3 list, I'm going to have to do it again as well. So, we'll think of something different for that one. Listen, it's a film you can talk a lot of time about, you know. So, so next week we're going to do There's Always Vanilla. If you want to get hold of me, please do. Email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. You can get me on Twitter. It's @orange_monkey. Go to the website, lasthorrorpodcast.com. All the podcasts are up there. What else? If you want to... Yeah, if you've got any opinions about this... that would be great. Thank you so much for the kind words of people who contacted me. If you look at my at replies, you can see a email from a guy, well, a tweet from a guy called Gav Crimson. That's onto my Twitter, @orange_monkey. And that is, he contacted somebody who was on the set for the film we spoke about last week, Suffer Little Children, and just he's kind of kindly shared that in terms of those memories. So go on Twitter and have a little look at that. So it's worth a look on the email. It's also got a bit from The Sun as well, which is nice in terms of some of the hysteria that they were pumping out about the film while it was being made. That's great. And again, thanks to lots of people who have been very nice about the fact that I've started podcasting again, which is really good. We've still got plenty more to come. Until next week, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.